Hey, podcast listeners, it's Chris popping in here to let you know you can now find Think on Instagram. That's where I'll be sharing book recommendations, favorite moments from recent shows, and occasional behind-the-scenes looks at how Think gets made. So while you're listening to today's podcast, I hope you'll give us a follow. Just search for K-E-R-A Think. Okay, now on to today's show.
Funding for the Think podcast comes from TCU, exploring renewable and sustainable energy sources to power a clean energy future. Stories of research can be found at endeavors.tcu.edu.
As adults with autism have taken a growing role in self-advocacy, many are pushing back on the idea that they somehow need fixing. But that doesn't mean autism is not a disability that makes a lot of things harder than for other people, not least because neurotypical people have set the world up based on their own needs and preferences without much consideration of how many challenges that world creates for folks whose brains work in different ways. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Long before he realized he was autistic, Devin Price just assumed he was broken in some way, trying to imitate behaviors that came naturally to his peers, even when those behaviors felt wrong or unnatural to him. And although he was already studying psychology, he had internalized a lot of common biases about autism that he now realizes are driven mostly by the expectation that good autistic people are the ones who find ways to make neurotypical people comfortable. Today, Price is a social psychologist, writer, and professor at Loyola University of Chicago's School of Continuing and Professional Studies. His book is called Unmasking Autism, Discovering the New Faces of Neurodiversity. Devin, welcome to Think.
Hi, Chris. Good afternoon.
When you moved to Chicago for grad school years ago, at the age of 21, you were having some real challenges in your life and in your relationships, but you thought, fine, I'll just put my nose to the grindstone, focus on work. But you felt like both you didn't fit in and you felt terribly isolated. Is that right?
Yeah, you know, I'm someone who I guess in prior years, people would have categorized me as a high functioning autistic person, though I didn't know at that point in time that I was autistic. I did very well academically, which is why I was even in graduate school that young. But I was really floundering at the social piece. I didn't know how to connect with people. I often rubbed people the wrong way or was blunt in a way that registered as rude. And so when I moved to a completely new city and kind of uprooted my life to start graduate school, to focus on the thing that I was good at, I really, really struggled because I didn't have any social supports in place.
Since it has just come up, I want to talk about why autism self-advocates kind of wish everybody would stop throwing around labels like high functioning and low functioning.
Yeah, it's very reductive is the simplest answer to why most in our community are not fans of it. There are some of us in the autistic community who we present in a way that's very respectable in society's eyes, you know, can work a job, can communicate effectively, can force ourselves to make eye contact. But it often comes at the expense of forgetting to eat, not having the energy to pursue anything we're passionate about because we need to recharge for hours every night from the exhaustion of being around people. There are just so many different aspects to the autistic experience. And the flip side is also true. Someone who might be really visibly disabled, who let's say can't verbally speak, they can potentially write on a computer and be just as capable or even more capable than myself at certain things. So it's too complicated to really flatten. And it also kind of perpetuates this idea that who we are should be measured by what we can do for other people, which just never goes anywhere good for people with disabilities.
So this is really interesting. You already had your PhD in psychology by the time your cousin told you he had been assessed for autism, and he basically just wanted to know what you knew about it. At the time, I guess the answer was you knew very little.
Yeah, you know, I told him, we were on vacation together, we were in a hot tub, and he asked me, and I said, well, I'm a social psychologist, I really only study, like, normal people. That's what I said. I had taken graduate level courses in clinical psychology and developmental psychology, and even from that, all I knew about autism was things that are untrue, actually. I thought it was a condition that was mostly in nonverbal boys who were obsessed with trains and science and math and things like that. And that I remember even being taught that that autistic people lacked a desire to socialize and lacked a desire for social connections, which is just patently untrue. Like, we struggle with it, but we often really desperately want to connect. And it wasn't until a family member of mine found out he was autistic and pointed out to me, "Hey, have you ever noticed all of these traits in our family that seem to be kind of on the spectrum or adjacent?" That I was like, "Oh no, this is not what I've been led to believe, and it also applies to me."
Where do those assumptions about autism, the whole, not just boys obsessed with trains, but like specifically upper middle class white boys obsessed with trains, where do those stereotypes come from?
It goes all the way back to the history of how autism was documented. So in Germany, Hans Asperger was kind of someone who did a lot of foundational writing on autism. And here in the US, Leo Kanner in the 40s and 50s was doing similar work. And they both, for a lot of reasons, were focusing only on, boys who were visibly disabled and presented some kind of quote unquote hassle to their upper middle class white families. Those were the families that mattered. And so, by extension, those were the kids who were, I can't say mattered, but were treated as a problem to be corrected because they were very much dehumanized too, even if they were getting treatment that the rest of us kind of generally weren't at that point in time. And so that informed what all of the diagnostic tools looked like. And that went on to kind of be a cyclical, self-perpetuating thing where if you have tools that are designed for that population, those are the only autistic people that you diagnose. And so then you continue refining the diagnostic tools to reflect that. And we've been really stuck with that stereotype for decades ever since.
So black and brown people with autism, girls with autism, gender minorities with autism all went unrecognized.
Yes. And to this day, it is a really pervasive problem. Women are diagnosed in far smaller numbers and at a far later age than cis men are. Black and brown autistics are often instead diagnosed with something like oppositional defiant disorder, which is a disorder that you usually see in kids who are seen as misbehaving and potentially antisocial in schools. It's a very stigmatizing label, and lots of black autistics get stuck with that. And sometimes even personality disorder diagnoses like narcissistic personality disorder or borderline is what a lot of those marginalized autistics get seen as, instead of this is a person with a disability that needs assistance. They get seen as this person has something wrong with their personality and they're manipulative or cruel or stubborn or, all of these really damaging ideas.
The current conventional wisdom floating around is that autistic people may be more likely than neurotypical folks to have a non-conforming or non-binary gender identity. Is that perception accurate?
I always like to, when people ask me why is there such a correlation between transness and autism, because we do see a very strong correlation in research. I always like to, when people ask me why that is, I always like to kind of flip it on its head and say, why are so many neurotypical people in the closet when we're so honest about it? Because we also know autistic people are more likely to be out as bisexual or gay, and yet we don't see as much hand-wringing or concern about that. And we also know from research that autistic people, when faced with a moral dilemma, we tend to be more morally consistent and willing to be whistleblowers at unethical companies. We just tend to be a group that is really firm in taking a stance for what we believe in. So it seems to me pretty self-evident that, of course, we're also known for being honest to a fault. Of course, we're more likely to be honest about who we are, even when it's a really stigmatized category like being trans. And so, how can we get to the place where neurotypical people feel comfortable being open about being trans as often as we are?
I mean, it feels like something to celebrate if autistic folks are more able to be who they are in this regard.
Yes, absolutely. It's a struggle sometimes being openly defiant of rules that strike us as unfair. That comes with a lot of social costs. But I think autistic people, we can really serve as a model for other people around us about, first of all, how neurodiversity just improves the human experience. It's good that people think and feel in different ways. And second of all, we can all let go of that fear that keeps us conforming to rules that don't feel right for us or that strike us as wrong. And I think autistic people are really good at modeling what that can look like.
So you had this family member who said, "Hey, have you noticed that lots of people in our family, have traits and behaviors that seem consistent with the autism spectrum?" You started doing just your own private research, not work research, and that work helped you understand that the problem wasn't you or any other autistic individual, but this world that seems almost deliberately designed to ignore your needs. Can you give us some examples of the way the world really doesn't pay attention to its effects on autistic people?
Sure. So for years before I had this revelation with my cousin, I thought that I was a really misanthropic person because I knew, you know, ever since I was even a teenager, that when I went out into crowded spaces or just even in between, you know, changing classrooms in school when I was still in school, I would be so irritated all the time. And I just hated everyone around me. That's what it felt like. So I assumed that I was kind of a bad person. And it wasn't until I learned that having a sensory overload or sensory overwhelm from all of the movement and the bright lights and the noises and the smells of all of those people, that can look like being really irritable and agitated. And having a meltdown, a sensory meltdown as an autistic adult or a teenager, you know, it doesn't look like a tantrum in a child necessarily. It can look like feeling really furious and feeling like I just need to get away from all of these people. And that is just something that I grapple with over and over again as someone who, you know, I'm a psychologist. I actually do find people very fascinating and I want to get to know them. But public transit, large event spaces, most workplaces, they're so busy, they're so bright, they're so overstimulating that I have to really budget my energy if I know that I'm going to be somewhere like that, which is most places. You know, the grocery store is an ordeal every single time.
If looking back, you now realize your autism has always been part of who you are, how do you think you escaped diagnosis for so many years?
So even just looking at the statistics, it's not surprising that I wasn't diagnosed because I was growing up in the early 90s. And back then, you know, a fraction of a percent of kids were assessed for autism back then. And they were really only looking, you know, school psychologists and teachers only knew to look for, again, the white cisgender boys obsessed with trains kind of stereotype. And instead, I was a weird, really talkative kid, which is not the stereotype of autism, even though there are a lot of autistic people who are super, super talkative. I was a very, very talkative kid. I was obsessed with bat species. I wanted to be a bat biologist and, you know, study them in the rainforest and things like that. And all of that was pretty easy to fold under, you know, this is just a quirky kid who's passionate about animals and is, you know, I was in gifted education, so that's why they're awkward. They're just awkward because, you know, they're smart and, you know, idiosyncratic. And so I think especially because I could succeed in school, people were like, oh, we don't have to worry about him. And that is the case for a lot of people like me. Again, lots of Black and brown autistics, lots of autistic girls, autistics in poverty, and anybody older than me. I'm a millennial. I'm 34. So anybody older than me had an even smaller chance of having been around anybody who even knew what autism really was, and probably eluded diagnosis because of that as well.
Your own experience with masking autism started with not wanting to be told you were acting like a baby. What did people tend to misunderstand about the ways you sometimes behaved in stressful situations?
Sure. Yeah. You know, I would ask a lot of questions about things that were obvious to everyone else. There's so much of social norms that neurotypical people seem to be able to just pick up through osmosis. I still don't really understand how people know, just upon walking into someplace new, here's where I'm going to stand, here's how I'm going to comport myself. You know, it just doesn't come intuitively to me. My interests, especially as a teenager and early teenage years, were, I guess, a little struck people as childlike. Like I still wore, you know, my glow in the dark bat t-shirts covered in all of my favorite like fruit bat species, you know, and just cartoony things and slept with stuffed animals and played pretend with toys and things like that. But those things were treated as shameful. And that's when I started realizing, okay, I need to pretend to be neurotypical or I'm going to be really bullied to no end.
So, Devin, you identify in the book some of the different forms masking can take for different people, whether they're consciously doing this or not. What are some of the sort of behaviors that folks engage in order to keep anybody from discovering that their brains are just different?
Yeah, so in the research literature, masking autism, the behaviors that go into that usually fall into one of two buckets: camouflaging and compensation. So camouflaging is things to just kind of avoid seeming weird or non-neurotypical to people. So, for example, one that's really common for autistic people is conversational scripting. So, I might watch Mad Men, and even though it's not a good source on how to behave in a workplace today, I might kind of study, okay, here's how people kind of subtly advocate for themselves during a work meeting, and I'm going to script my own future interactions at the office based on what I've seen on this show. Another example of camouflage would be things like faking facial expressions, practicing them in the mirror, because we notice that neurotypical people are not good at reading our actual facial expressions. So learning to fake ones that they can read. And then compensation are just taking strategies to kind of basically create a life that's livable, even though we lack the accessibility that we need. So one really common example of that is autistic people, we are underemployed at really high rates, and we have always kind of gravitated towards work from home and freelance jobs because there's a lot more control over your environment and your schedule, and just more freedom to kind of get the recharge time that you need. That often means we earn a lot less than our neurotypical peers, but that's one way that many of us have to kind of compensate to get by. So those are just some rough examples, but there are just so many different ways and forms that autistic people try to present and conform as more neurotypical in order to get by.
So in some cases, people are trying to compensate without even fully realizing that's what they're doing. What sort of toll does that take?
It's really, really cognitively draining and exhausting. In the book, I talk about one autistic woman who, for example, anytime she is meeting friends at a restaurant or a new place, she looks it up on Google Maps. She sees if she can find a floor plan of the inside of the restaurant. She reads through the whole menu. She practices making sure she knows how to pronounce anything that's on the menu. All of these efforts that for most neurotypical people, it would just never cross your mind to prep for a casual hangout like that. And that kind of behavior is super exhausting. It means we have less energy to pursue our hobbies and passions, to take care of ourselves in our homes. It means we socialize less. And we also know in the research that the more heavily someone masks, the more likely they are to be depressed, socially anxious, and even at an increased risk of suicide ideation. Because, you're not living a life that's true to yourself. And so that is a really, it's a really heavy existential burden. So a lot of us feel a lot of despair, especially when we're in the throes of masking all the time with everyone.
Because you weren't diagnosed as a child, you weren't given the standard forms of behavioral therapy, but you do have some concerns that what is called treatment for autism may be something like training in masking. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so if a kid gets diagnosed with autism in the US, they are very likely to be referred to something called applied behavioral analysis or ABA therapy. And the thing that's really important for people to know is that the inventor of ABA therapy, Ole Ivar Lovaas, he also was the inventor of anti-gay conversion therapy. And he had the same goal with both of those therapies, to train kids who are different into conforming more, because it'll be better for them if they just blend in, if they're not gay, and if they know how to socialize like a neurotypical. ABA therapy is really heavily criticized by most members of the autistic community. It seems to be linked with PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder symptoms, and that's because kids who are put through it can have a really harrowing experience where they are forced to parrot back a normal conversation. And if they don't make eye contact, they might be punished or forced to just sit still in a chair and be ignored until they perform the right behaviors. Sometimes they're barred from talking about their special interests, the topics that they're passionate about. Sometimes even ABA therapists use electric shocks or hot sauce to punish kids for not conforming. It is really, really harsh, and it's because it was just designed to make a autistic kid seem on the outside more neurotypical, no matter how much internal pain that brought them.
So now, as an adult who really wants to resist the social pressure to mask your autism, I wonder how you make the call on what is autism and what is just sort of the way people are. For example, as a neurotypical person, if a friend tells me a long story that I'm not that interested in, you know, I don't want to hurt their feelings, so I just sort of let them continue talking, and then when it's possible, change the subject. But I don't have to do this thing where I'm asking myself, is this the right thing to do or the wrong thing to do? I wonder how often those questions are buzzing around in your head.
Oh, gosh. Yeah. Being autistic in a neurotypical society means many of us are kind of constantly kind of gaslighting ourselves. Maybe that's too dramatic or overused of a term, but when you've been told all your life that you're awkward, that you're saying the wrong thing, that you're missing something, it makes it really, really hard to trust your own feelings or perceptions of anything. So I think, and certainly in my research for this book, almost all of the autistic people that I spoke to do have this constant monologue in their head of, am I a bad person for not, you know, listening, for missing this detail, for getting bored, for am I not giving enough signs that I'm really interested? A lot of us become really, really adept at kind of what's sometimes called the fawning response to stress, which means being really agreeable, really personable. Just we're so desperate to kind of get some positive social feedback after years of getting really bad social feedback all the time, that it's really hard to trust your own instincts and your own needs in those moments.
I thought it was interesting you write about a revelation that you had. You've always been aware that it can be hard for you to kind of read between the lines of what people are saying to you, but you've come to realize plenty of neurotypical people are also very bad at this. So how do you handle it when you're not sure if somebody is trying to communicate more to you than precisely what they've just said?
These days, I'm in the kind of position where I can usually say, okay, are you asking me if we have any butter in the fridge because you want me to go grab it? You know, that kind of like unspoken thing that a lot of neurotypical people do. Or are you bringing up concerns with this project because you think we shouldn't go forward with it at work or something like that? I'm lucky to be in a really supportive academic department at Loyola. And I think just through years of practice, I've learned that, professionally for me at least, a lot of times people really appreciate when there's somebody who will cut through the vagueness and say, okay, but do we actually have the budget for this? Or like, what's our timeline for this? Or I'm the person who's like, why are we even having a meeting right now? I don't understand what our goal is. Like, you know, these like very specific questions that in a different situation, people might think I'm being super rude, but I guess it's a combination of luck and having developed social skills slowly over time where I've realized neurotypical people benefit from clear, direct communication too. I think actually all of us are secretly craving it on some level. So being able to be somebody who helps cut through that fog has been really beneficial, I think, for me and for some of the people around me. That's not true for every autistic person. Sometimes we really get punished for saying the things people don't want to hear. But I think there's a lot of value in being that person.
Devin, I love you have a section in the book in which you consider the ways we might reframe stereotypes around autism. So what are more positive ways that we might look at accusations that somebody is arrogant or hypersensitive or weird?
Yeah. So I'll just go down the line there because a lot of the negative stereotypes of autism are really focused on how we look or present a frustration to someone from the outside, and usually just from someone who doesn't know any better, or, you know, say a parent who doesn't have the supports in place and doesn't know any better at the outset. So things like arrogance. I already mentioned how autistic people, we tend to be more morally consistent and more willing to take a stand than neurotypical people. Sometimes that means that we do come across as really, you know, brusque and arrogant and sure of ourselves. But humanity needs people who are willing to push that envelope. Doesn't always mean it's easy, but it really helps just us as an entire, you know, species move forward. Same thing with weirdness too. You know, autistic people, we really have founded a lot of nerdy communities online. Steve Silberman, in his book Neurotribes, talks about how autistic people started the first science fiction conventions in the early, like, late 1800s, early 1900s. They started science fiction conventions, which is so mind-boggling. Like, they rode the backs of trains to go meet each other and talk about their favorite science fiction books. So our weirdness helps us create these communities devoted to whatever it is that we're passionate about. And even things that, you know, that I had demeaned in myself, like childishness, as a disabled person, that really just means that we're in touch with our capacity for joy and wonder and curiosity. Like, basically every autistic trait that gets written off as bad or annoying, it actually is just someone being really passionate and open, in a way that can be challenging, but I think for humanity's benefit.
How does it happen, do you think, that autistic people's special interests and obsessions, which not every autistic person has, but it is something that people talk about, why is that often perceived as like over the top when our culture celebrates a CEO who spends 90 hours a week working, or you know, a dancer who, you know, is in the studio for that long every week?
I think because it's not profitable to someone, unfortunately. Because, you know, there are a lot of autistic people in tech. A lot of autistic people get kind of celebrated at if they're good and passionate about programming or math or something that is profitable or respectable to others. Then we're kind of seen as assets and kind of at least tolerated as long as we're still useful, you know. But when autistic people were when we're passionate about, you know, some cartoon that was around when we were growing up, or some really niche subject that others can't see an immediate profit off of, that's when they call us childish or see us as frivolous or detached from reality or not social enough, even though pursuing your special interests, pursuing your passions, first of all, that's just what makes life worth living for any of us, I think. And also, it helps bring you close to other people. We build events and web spaces and internet infrastructure around cataloging information about the stuff we're passionate about. We find each other because of those passions, and that's a beautiful thing.
So many parents of autistic kids work so hard to be the first and primary advocates for their own children, but of course, those children will grow up. Do you have suggestions for raising an autistic child to become a self-advocate eventually?
Yeah, I think it's all about helping to nourish in your kid confidence in their own autonomy. So many of us mask, so many of us feel like we have to quiet any side of ourselves that makes us seen as a burden to others, and that really shreds your self-confidence. And for a lot of us, when we get older, we really lose touch with who we even are because we're so used to conforming and trying to not be the nail that stands up too straight and gets knocked down by the world. So I think make sure that you surround your kid with as many autistic people as you can. Help them meet other autistic kids, help them meet autistic adults so they can see the different ways that life could look for them and kind of trade with these people tips and tricks for how to self-advocate. And have lots of really honest conversations with your kid about, you know, so someone at school reacted to you this way, or someone at school said this, or a teacher looked at you funny for having this need. Knowing that the world is unfortunately full of that stuff, what are the things that I can do to support you? What are the skills that I can help leave you with so that you know how to rebuild your self-confidence when these things happen? Because unfortunately, they are going to happen sometimes. And how can you kind of seek out the things in life that make you feel whole and okay? And that might mean that your kid is on a very different life path than what you initially thought, before you knew they were autistic. Success as an autistic person looks a lot of different ways, but if they are happy and they're around people who care about them and they are in touch with who they really are, you should consider that a huge success because there's a lot of forces out there that push us to not be that authentic.
I mentioned it in the introduction, but I want to say it again. In the book, you say autism is a disability. It can make some things harder, especially given the way the world is set up. That said, though, Devin, looking at your life today, are there ways you think your autism has contributed to your success, to being the person you are today that you're happy with?
Yeah, there's no teasing apart who I am. from autism. The fact that I work as a writer and do things like this comes from the fact that I found regular conversations with people really hard. And so to deal with that in high school, I got really involved in speech and debate, and I was passionate and obsessive about it. And I learned, okay, this thing, communicating with people that I find super unintuitive, I can develop a system for how to do it. I can learn how to do it and how to master it. And that made me an effective writer and a good educator too. And it also meant that I was able to empathize with my students when they're struggling or they find something confusing and they need it really carefully broken down for them. It's come with a lot of struggles, but I'm glad that I've kind of had that post-traumatic growth that comes from those struggles that helps you connect with other people and know what they're going through and know how to reach them where they're at. So yeah, absolutely. I would not be here if it weren't for being autistic.
You write in the book about Samuel Dillon Finch and his philosophy about looking for the strawberry people in his life. What does he mean by that?
Yeah, oh, I love the strawberry people exercise. So Sam Dillon Finch talks about how, because of masking, he couldn't always distinguish between who are people that are really good for me in my life and who are people that I'm just being nice to because I'm so afraid of being ostracized. And so he really sat down and asked himself, who are the people in my life that I think of as being too nice to me, that I don't trust how consistent they are because I'm not used to people treating me with consistency? And those were the people that he put in his phone next to their names in his contacts. He put a little strawberry emoji to symbolize that these people really help me grow and I really want to grow these friendships more. And so then, whenever one of his strawberry people texted him, those people were always a priority, that he would get back to them. He would not bail on plans with them, even though these are usually the kinds of people that you can bail on and they won't judge you. And he just talks about how once he realized who those people were in his life and really put them first, they became like a found family to him and they all became friends with each other. And he finally had the sense of community for the first time. So yeah, I really love that exercise. I think a lot of us struggle with that piece of who can we really trust and what relationships can we really nourish.
Given that you don't want to mask anymore, how do you make decisions about whether or not to tell a new person in your life about your autism?
I'm in an unusual position since I'm now like a public autism person, so it kind of comes out. But I think I come across as pretty autistic to people these days because I've never had that, but you don't seem autistic answer that some people get. So I think that means I'm succeeding at being weird in an unavoidable way, which is good. But if I'm going to know anybody in a really serious way, it's going to come up. If it's just a one-off interaction, I'm not going to dump that on someone and have either of us have to deal with it. But for me, autism is such an integral part of who I am, and to understanding how to communicate with me and to what to be patient about, that it comes out very, very quickly. And it's really, really improved my relationships. People are so much more warm with me now that they know that I'm not being cold, I'm not being sarcastic. This is just how I sound, and yeah, so for me, I've been really lucky that I get to be really open about it these days, and it's really paid a lot of social dividends.
It really is interesting that we're not used to just allowing people to say and do and be exactly who they are.
And I always say unmasking's for everyone because neurotypical people, we have to fake and hide certain sides of themselves, especially at work or high pressure social environments too. We all feel this pressure to pretend to be something we're not. And the more we just relax a little bit and let ourselves just be who we are, with whatever awkwardness comes from that, with whatever conflict occurs, it frees all of us to be, more ourselves and more authentic.
Devin Price is a social psychologist, writer, and professor at Loyola University of Chicago School of Continuing and Professional Studies. His book is Unmasking Autism: Discovering the New Faces of Neurodiversity. Devin, thanks so much for talking with us today.
Thanks so much for having me. This was a really great conversation.
You can like our page on Facebook. On Twitter, we're at KERA Think. And if you want the podcast, go wherever you get your podcasts, search for KERA Think, and then just subscribe. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.